So I'm here with Laurie Sandel, who is most recently the author of The Imposter's Daughter. Laurie, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. I first must ask you if, in fact, chicken pot pie is still your specialty.
Sadly, as the self-proclaimed terrified chef, it is. I have about two dishes that I make, and that's one of them.
Oh, what's the other second dish?
It's another chicken dish. It's just chicken with lemon sauce and, you know, rice on the side.
Yeah,
I mean, literally,
all right.
That's all I make.
Chicken will work. Chicken will work. Away from the pedantic and down to the nitty-gritty. Your book deals very much with the notion of truth. I mean, you insist that this is a true memoir. Now, memoirs, of course, often involve character composites, the shifting of events, the, minor prevarications in order for everything to be crammed rather neatly into a smooth narrative. This novel may be a true memoir, but I must ask you, to what degree did you stretch the truth to this? I can't possibly believe that everything in it is true. You had to at least massage a few things in order to make it all work because, of course, as we all know, the truth that we experience is much different from the narrative we put forth, even in a memoir. So, rather complicated matter. Let's go ahead and start.
I think that's actually a great question, especially in this age post-James Frey. And the fact that, you know, Little Brown, when they received the book, actually vetted the entire thing through lawyers, which is something that they didn't used to have to do. But I did not stretch the truth in terms of this book at all. I mean, I'd love for you to ask me about specific events, and then I can tell you, you know, how they happened. But everybody's story is completely subjective. So I told my story as my own subjective truth. You know, I, like, decided what incidents I was going to put into the book, and that creates a narrative that, of course, creates its own arc of truth. But as far as the specific incidents as they happened, I didn't stretch the truth. I was pretty careful not to, especially given the subject matter.
But it is your own subjective memory as opposed to an objective, definitive account.
Absolutely.
So the question is to what degree did you worry about the fact that your own subjective viewpoint was getting in the way of chronicling these particular events?
Well, I worried about it a lot. That's why when I wrote that essay originally for Esquire back that came out in 2003, I didn't put my name on it. I wrote it anonymously because I was still, you know, getting to the bottom of the events. And as I learned with my father, I'll probably never get to the absolute core of the apple. You know, there's kind of another thing comes up as I discover something else. And so, you know, I was constantly digging and trying to figure it out. But it's hard for me to say what, you know, you are suggesting I stretched, because it really was just more me picking and choosing incidents that I felt illustrated the type of childhood that I had.
I should point out, I'm not trying to insist that stretching is necessarily a bad thing. I'm merely pointing out that memory, as we all know, is a fallacious instrument.
Yes, it is.
It's been said that, you know, memory is the greatest liar of them all. It's been said that I believe Lincoln said that you have to have a great memory to be a good liar. And so, given this conundrum, I'm wondering to what degree you relied on your own memory and to what degree you relied on reference shots. You have, for example, illustrations that crop up within the course of the book. This leads me to also wonder about specific other details, but maybe we could start on memory versus concrete evidence.
Yeah, well, you know what? It was a mix of memory and concrete evidence. On the one hand, I had a lot of concrete evidence because I had interviewed my father over a period of 2 years, and I tape recorded our conversations with his knowledge. This was leading up to the Esquire piece, and I had a 300-page transcript. So most of the things that my father said in the book came directly from those transcripts. So if he's telling stories of his past, those came directly from that transcript and directly from my father's mouth.
Yeah.
You know, as far as, you know, trying to think. I don't know. What else?
Well, I could actually cite a specific example.
Okay,
I want
sure.
to go general, but for example, the difference between the narration and what is actually spoken in the text bubbles.
Right.
You have, for example, a text box. Here's one example.
Mm-hmm.
When you're working at the office, you have a text box point to the screen, have you considered inpatient treatment? We don't actually see the email on the screen.
Okay.
We actually see your particular perspective.
Right.
And so I wanted to ask you about why that particular emphasis was, I mean, that's inherently subjective because we're counting upon your subjective viewpoint as to what is on the screen.
As opposed to
later on, or actually earlier than that, you actually see what's on the screen when you're on your laptop in a hotel room.
I mean, to be honest, the reason you didn't see that on the screen is probably because it didn't fit in that box.
Okay.
And so I had to sort of do a little call out so you could actually see what was on the screen. But the interesting thing about the process of, you know, putting together all this evidence, and a lot of it really was evidence, is that there were so many emails. For example, that email was an email, I believe, from Ashley Judd.
Yeah.
And I have those emails from Ashley Judd. I have emails from my father. I have, you know, I worked with a private investigator for 2 years, so I have all of his information and the lawsuits he compiled and all the various evidence and things written by my father. And, you know, I think, did you ever read Autobiography of a Face by Lucy Grayley?
I'm sorry?
Did you ever read Autobiography of a Face by Lucy Grayley?
No, I never read
the memoir.
That.
It's a beautiful, wonderful memoir. Ann Patchett later went on to write Truth and Beauty about their friendship.
That's right.
And one of the things that Ann Patchett said in her afterword, after Lucy died, Ann Patchett wrote an afterword to the book, and she described how at a reading, you know, someone said to Lucy Grayley, how did you remember all of these details about your past? And she said, I didn't remember it, I wrote it.
Yeah.
And people were sort of a little bit up in arms about that, but she was pointing out the fact that this is a piece of art, it's a piece of subjective memory, you know, and the most important thing is to show the emotional truth of the situation.
Yeah.
And I would say that in my case, because I have so much evidence and evidence that Little Brown asked to see, and anytime I've done television, they've actually asked to see the evidence, I feel pretty comfortable that, you know, there's not going to be any big explosive James Fry situation.
Yeah. Well, to what degree were they asking for the evidence? Because we're talking about transcripts.
Yep.
And we're talking about investigative reports. This
yep.
is all text right now. And here you are, you have a visual
yes.
document here.
Yes.
So you have to, I suppose, construct something from the text here, and so this leads
right,
me to wonder
true.
As to whether evidence even means anything if it's a visual result. You know?
I think it does. I mean, the visual result is obviously my memory. You know,
yeah.
it's the way I remember the situation. If you look at my childhood cartoons, and some of which are in the book, those are also my memory of the situation or my interpretation of the situation. But a lawyer went over every word of the book because, of course, they don't want to be liable for anything in the book that might not be true.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as the drawings, of course, they're all from my memory,
yeah.
you know, unless I was illustrating a photograph.
Yeah. Well, I'd be curious, too, because let's take, for example, the use of clothes against backgrounds.
The use of
clothing against background.
Okay.
For example, in the many sequences in Los Angeles, you often, like in one moment, you have Ben wearing a purple shirt,
uh-huh.
and it's against a green couch, and these colors completely contradict each other. They're not exactly what you would expect to have be the natural art direction. And yet simultaneously, this book contains many like bright hues and the like. So I'm wondering if a decision like that comes back down to this so-called documentation or your memory or where you can fib a little with the color scheme in order to make it look visually appealing.
Well, I don't know if you noticed in the acknowledgments or in the front of the book, but I actually hired someone to do the color. I didn't do the color in the book.
Okay,
Paige Pooler, a wonderful Los Angeles illustrator, did the color. And of course, we worked on Choices Together and all
yeah.
of that. But that was probably a color choice of Paige's.
Uh-huh.
You know? Yeah.
Uh-huh. So you had no input whatsoever on the color?
I had input. I mean, of course, she showed me all of the color, and we
yeah.
talked about, you know, themes and things like that. But
okay.
she largely chose the color. She's a wonderful illustrator, and I trusted her. So.
Did Little Brown and lawyers demand evidence of her? They go after her. Hey, that's not the color in the investigative report.
I sure hope not.
Yeah.
I think those colors may have come from her imagination.
I also wanted to ask you, for example, you include a good deal of your art. We had talked about that. You have an asterisk essentially saying, hey, actual drawing.
Yes.
But I'm wondering if you had some difficulties in finding all these notes, these ephemera, these visual artifacts that you could actually then put within the book. I mean, surely you didn't have everything. I mean, nobody has everything. Nobody has the entire remnants of everything they've ever put to paper. I mean, there are moves, there are fires, there are whatever. So I'm curious as to how you dealt with these potential missing periods in your life, or whether you just skipped over them or anything along those lines.
You mean like, for example, the 4-year period where I was traveling around the world,
yes,
when I worked in Japan,
like
when I did the stripper stint, all
yeah.
of that stuff?
Yeah.
I mean, sure, of course, some of that stuff has to come from my memory. I don't have, you know, the card that says, yes, I worked at Party Pink in Yokohama. I did.
Sworn affidavit.
I certainly hope that doesn't turn up anywhere. I mean, you know, I have, anytime that there's a document in the book, for example, when my father took out credit cards in my name,
yeah.
I took a document and I essentially traced the document. So that is right there in the book. But I didn't want to do a mixture of, you know, photographs and illustrations. I wanted the entire book to be illustrated. Plus, I thought it was an interesting way to do things because my father was dealing with so much fantasy that for me it was kind of nice to have that juxtaposed against the illustrations, which are their own kind of fantasy.
Yeah.
And I'm not shying away from the fact that for a long period of time, I think I was trying to dig so deep into my father's life to escape him, and in some way I sort of became like him.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that too.
Huh. This also makes me ask you about the use of, for example, occasional motion lines. Ashley Judd's dog wags his tail. We see the motion lines. There's one moment where you're basically passed out and, quote, cuddling with Ben, and your eyes are in this circular, hypnotic, spaced-out, cartoonish manner. These are rather surprising moments because, for the most part, you stick with a fairly naturalistic look throughout the entire book, for the most part, with these few exceptions. And I'm wondering if there was any methodology or ground rules that you laid down with which, okay, I can go a little cartoony here, or maybe because it's a graphic novel or because it's a comic, you have to inherently adopt certain comic book semiotics.
I think it's more about adopting certain comic book semiotics. I mean, first of all, I'm a novice in the world of doing comics. You know, it's something that the story itself kind of chose the form for me because I have always cartooned about my father. But he's pretty much the only person I've always cartooned about. And I've done cartoons on my own and I follow comic books and that sort of thing. But, you know, it's not like I made these very deliberate choices. I feel like the reason that I chose to do the book this way is because I was afraid to talk about my father on some level in the straightforward memoir form. I did write the book as a straightforward memoir first. I had 350 pages down and I threw it out. And I think it's because, you know, the story was unfolding as I wrote and I was terrified that my father was going to hurt himself or maybe hurt me. Or I was afraid of my father. And so basically, you know, I turned back to my childhood cartoons. I saw that I'd always talked about him in this incredibly fearless fashion when I was a kid. And I thought, maybe if I start doing that as an adult, the story will be able to go deeper, and I was right. So as far as making these choices, you know, it's me doing a comic book kind of for the first time in my life and drawing from a part of my brain that was just intuitive rather than, you know, maybe so intellectual.
Which causes two questions out of curiosity here. I mean, why was text such an imposing form with which to go ahead and pursue this particular truth? I mean, why was the visual idea here truer than text? And there was another question I had, but I'll start with that
Start with that one, okay. You know, when I was writing the memoir, I really wanted it to be a straightforward memoir. I'm a huge fan of memoir. I mean, I love Mary Carr's The Liar's Club and Tobias Wolff's This Boy's Life, and I'm really obsessed with memoir. I've read many memoirs. And so I wanted to do it that way, but I could see as I was writing that I was holding back on some level and that my father was kind of in the room with me as I was writing. I felt like he was almost overseeing the project and I was holding back. And for some reason, I think wrongly, I assumed that cartoons are lighter and they're more fun and it's not going to be as dangerous to talk about my father in that format. And for some reason in that moment, it's as if I forgot that Art Spiegelman dealt with the Holocaust in Mouse. You know, it's not a form that generally does deal with light subjects.
Although he put the mice in, so therefore that's kind of light.
It's a way to make it palatable, you know. But in the end, it was incredibly dark subject matter in a light-looking form. But I think it just freed me on some level. I think in a way, it freed me because I always felt like free to tell the truth about my father in that form. And I think on another level, because my father was the recipient of all of these cartoons when I was a kid and I gave them to him as gifts, maybe on some level I thought I had permission from my father to talk about him in this form. I mean, I'm talking armchair psychology, subconscious stuff, but
Well, I mean, the question is whether you really truly were free. If you didn't feel liberated enough in text form, how then did you feel liberated in comic form? And again, this goes back to another question I have. I mean, you wrote this anonymous essay. Was it possibly the anonymity that kind of gave you that liberation when you approached the less essay? If you had done this book, for example, you know, by Jane Doe, it would have actually been liberating for you, perhaps, if it had been in text form? What of this?
I mean, this is a tricky situation because my father is alive. He's married to my mother. A lot of people write memoirs about people that are not alive. And so, you know, granted we were estranged already when I started writing this book, but I'm very close to my sisters, I'm close to my mother, I'm a part of my family, so I had to sort of contend with that. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I am a writer. I've always written in the text form. I've written a lot of personal essays about myself. I've revealed a lot about myself in personal essays. But I think when I wrote the Esquire piece, it was the first time that I had kind of gone into this part of my history that was very secret, you know, carried a lot of fear within it. And it was, in some way, I felt like my father was this person who was looming over my life, and I had to sort of exorcise him.
Yeah. But if you're putting so much of yourself out there in book form, you have to keep some element of privacy to yourself. You can't spill everything.
Right.
I mean, I'm wondering if the comic format actually caused you to create a greater separation between your own privacy and what you divulge to the public. I mean, I see some memoirists face this dilemma where they've spilled every conceivable detail, and what do they have? And they sometimes go nuts later on in life.
Right. Let's hope that doesn't happen.
Yeah, yeah.
I really...
You seem fairly level-headed, thank goodness.
Thank goodness, you're right. Well, I still haven't had a healthy relationship, but other than that. You know, I feel that I chose details to put in the story that were specific to this story about my father. Anything that I put in the story about my father was specific to my dealing with the truth. Anything that I put in the story about myself was specific to how my father not telling the truth affected my life as an adult woman.
Yeah.
So there's a lot I left out of the story. Obviously, I put in a lot of things that are, you know, exposed me on some level and maybe made me undateable, I don't know, but they did, you know, they made sense for the story.
Yeah.
And they were choices that I made.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of myself that I've kept private, of course.
You know, I'm wondering if by approaching this whole story from your father's viewpoint, this was a way for you to get at, for example, the fact that you were totally dosing yourself up on Ambien and all this over the years, that you were actually making serious mistakes, whether the father's perspective actually permitted you to finally come closer to your truth, whether you need this. Maybe it's similar to the anonymity we were talking about earlier, that you need some sort of outside third party with which to actually get into the first person, so to speak.
Well, I think that all of that stuff that I was doing was because my father was on some level, because he would always say, you know, A is B. And
yeah.
I could see even from a young age that B was A.
Yeah.
It caused me to subjugate my authentic self. And that's very painful to do that.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what led to the drug addiction, you know, and the alcohol abuse. And basically, I think absolutely pursuing this story about my father and pursuing the truth is what allowed me to get back to a true sense of identity of who I am. I mean, I spent many, many years with this story as my identity.
Yeah.
You know, to me, this story was who I was. And anytime I met someone, this was the first thing I told them about was my father.
Yeah.
And now the only time I talk about my father is when I'm talking about my book. I just don't feel the need to anymore.
So
and
basically, when you go on dates in the future, you can just hand them the book.
I'm going to try to hide the book. I'm kidding.
Actually, this sense of your personal self is interesting in light of one thing I observed. When you are in the clinic late in the book, mm-hmm. you have a floor plan overlooking what you did in specific rooms.
Yes.
Now, at the very beginning, in the cul-de-sac in California, you have, of course, a diagram, and I'm from California, so I recognize that exact elliptical end. But what's interesting is that you don't say exactly what you did there. You actually just point to people you knew. I found this to be a very interesting distinction, one that you were possibly conscious of, or...
I would say I was more unconscious of that, but now that you point it out, I really like what you're saying, because it's true. In the beginning, I was a child. I was sort of taking everything that my father said and did at face value, as any child would.
Yeah.
And then in the end, I was kind of looking at things in a much more concrete, bird's eye view fashion.
Yeah. Well, I mean, how important is knowing the lay of the land for you, because you need to, again, know the lay of your own existence?
Meaning
to the relation of how you know your place, whether it's through who was there or what you did there, to how you make sense of how you lived as a whole.
Right. Well, I think I wanted to point out that diagram in the rehab place just because I wanted to be very transparent about what was going on there, and because it helped me quite a bit, quite frankly. And, you know, I think that the entire way I live my life is transparent now, and it wasn't before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before there was a persona that I projected, much like my father projected a persona, and then there was the person that I was inside. And I think I feel integrated now, so.
The other question I had, which was very curious, was your tendency to rely very much on static panels, where you have often conversations between you and Ben in Los Angeles, and essentially you don't really move. There's one that goes on for 3 pages the I'm not sure I'm in love with you moment,
right?
Where you guys don't even move. You don't even come close, really. It's just that same series over and over and over again. And I'm wondering how consciously you were fixated upon these static shots like this, and versus the kinetic, or whether it was just a easier way for you to come with the truth, if it's essentially like Muybridge's horse or whatnot.
Right. Well, I don't think that was necessarily, I mean, again, this whole thing was visual, you know, in my head as I was writing it. I'm new to the graphic novel form. There are probably a lot of tricks that I have yet to learn, and I'm sure that there's a way to break the panels and, you know, do all kinds of interesting things with them. And as I've been reading more and more graphic novels, I've thought, oh, I wish I could go back and, you know, put these people here and do this and break the panels up that way. But I think the most important thing for me in this book was the story. I really wanted to get the story across. I wanted it to be visual because that's the way I've always talked about my father. But as far as doing all kinds of dazzling tricks in the graphic novel form, I mean, hopefully that will be something in the future you know, for me to try.
Well, you mentioned Spiegelman earlier. Did you consult any graphic novels before you embarked on this journey, so to speak?
I mean, obviously I read tons of graphic novels, and I read books on how to construct graphic novels. You know, I read Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics and Making Comics. I have a little panel in the book about The Complete Idiot's Guide to creating a graphic novel, which I also looked at. And I got to know some cartoonists when I was in Portland because I drew part of the book in Portland, Oregon. So I got to know Craig Thompson and, you know, just it's a great tradition that I'm very much at the beginning of the road. So
we were kind of getting into this earlier, and that is the conflict between the narration and what occurs in the panel. I want to cite a couple of examples. You write, for example, in one, in group therapy sessions, the counselor started pushing me to break up with Ben. But that's not exactly what actually occurs in the panel, because the therapist says, you've said you feel ambivalent about him and that he doesn't support you in your recovery. Now, as a reader, I'm inclined to infer that the therapist is merely repeating what you have said to the therapist. And so, as a result, I wanted to again ask, to what degree was this a conscious decision to separate your own subjective reflections back on this particular time versus what you seem to remember of that time? Likewise, somewhat related to this, I had to look at the sort of colored backgrounds for all the text and think, oh, well, perhaps this narration is a bit colored in its in its testimony. So what of this bag of tricks here?
Well, I certainly didn't want to just reflect exactly what was said over the panel, you know, in the panel. I mean, I think you want to have a dynamic difference between what's happening in the narration and what's happening in the panel itself. So I think that's really all it comes down to.
You didn't really fixate on having two different forms of memory occurring at the same time with the narration and what was happening in the panel?
No, but I like that you found it in the book.
Okay,
I think that's great.
Okay.
I mean, I'll go with your interpretation.
The arrow is pointing to objects and figures. They become increasingly more pronounced as the book goes on. What of this? Why? I mean, going back to the question of realism that we were talking about earlier, this is probably one of the only major digressions away from that. And why the need to constantly identify things along those lines? Was just a...
Well, there were certain things that I felt were important to identify, like the tape recorders that were in the panels. I mean, I think that really falls under the heading of evidence. You know, I think I wouldn't point out dog, you know, that sort of thing, but there were tape recorders in various panels, and I wanted it to be known that this, for example, is on the record.
Yeah.
So, is there anything specific that comes to mind, or?
No, I just was just kind of curious, because, I mean, they become, you gradually start to identify more things, particularly as you start to move and shift into more of these hotels for these various interviews that you were doing and the like, and so suddenly.
Well, it's also, I mean, I would have to think specifically about which panels you're pointing to, but if we're talking about the hotels, I think part of it is the split in me between being invited into a 5-star hotel as if I belong there, you know, and being completely incredulous, what am I doing here? You know, this isn't my world.
Yeah.
And again, that to me parallels the experience of my father, who wanted so badly to be in these situations and settings and wasn't of those situations and settings and couldn't get into them. And so on some level, it was like, what am I doing here? And then I'm pointing out these things to myself, like, look at this, I can't believe this is in the room, you know?
Well, I mean, that makes total sense. I also wanted to ask you about the text balloons and the narration. In some cases, you have the text balloons extremely sleek in the way that you drew them, where the lines are absolutely crisp, and in other times, they stray dramatically, and you don't even care about how straight they are. Was this conscious, or was this a laziness? What happened here?
There was no laziness involved in the making of this book, I assure you. However, I probably wasn't as deliberate and conscious as, you know, a trained, you know, many years graphic novelist.
Yeah.
I mean, again, you know, I had to throw out the first 20 pages of the book and do them again.
Yeah.
Because I realized as I went on, oh, the drawing is getting better and the first 20 pages seem kind of sloppy compared to that. So there may have been some things that potentially slipped through the crack, or maybe I changed some of my style, you know, at certain places in the book. And I think that's really kind of all it boils down to.
Well, to what degree did you have to go back to earlier pages and say, oh, well, this is not working because something you have done later on actually affects the beginning? And did you do much of that?
I did some of that. I mean, I sketched out, you know, most of the book before I started drawing. So I did have a script to a certain extent to work from. I wasn't working directly from the script, but I had an arc and I had an outline of sorts. So I did have to go back and rearrange things and throw things out and that kind of thing. But I knew where I was going, even from the first page.
But
I also had this memoir that I'd written, you know.
Yes, exactly.
So, of course, I took some things from the memoir, and so there was some of that. I integrated some things from the memoir into it as well.
How much did you take from the text version of the memoir? I'm curious.
I mean, text itself, not a whole lot, but
yeah.
The story arc,
okay.
A lot of it came from the memoir.
Did writing the memoir out like that help you to have a sort of fixed outline with which to carry forward with the...
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was very helpful. Yeah. I had to throw the whole thing out, you know, but yeah.
I'm curious if, to what degree did you stray then from this? I mean, to what degree, I suppose, do you require structure? To what degree do you require spontaneity in the recalling of memory like this?
Well, this entire process from start to finish took about 7 years. So
yes.
There was a lot of straying. You know, there was a lot of two steps forward, one step back kind of thing. I mean, I started out with the Esquire piece, and I had a book in my mind even as I was doing that. And... you know, then there were a couple of years of false starts and writing, and finally the drawing came at the end.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that I pretty much would love to have a structure. I think my mind works well with a structure,
yeah.
But because of the emotional aspect of writing this book, because of the fact that it was a memoir, because it was unfolding as I wrote, there were a lot of situations in which I had to kind of deal with the emotional aspect of what was happening and then go back to the writing.
Yeah.
Because you have to have perspective before
yeah.
you can sit down and write a memoir.
Huh. I'm curious, how long did it generally take you to, for example, recover from some particularly painful memory? I mean, you needed a momentum to keep on going, and 7 years is quite a long time
to
do a start and stop kind of scenario like this.
Also, keep in mind, I had a full-time job,
yes.
you know, while I was trying to work on this, so that made things difficult, and I would go to writer's colonies and try to work on it then. But as far as the emotional distance that I needed, my father stopped speaking to me in 2002, which was a year before the Esquire piece came out. It's when I first confronted him about his degrees. He cut off communication. So I would say there were a good three years there after we stopped speaking that I was writing, but I was not writing anything that I've used. And then after that, of course, I went into rehab and I got sober. So there was that sort of thing, too.
That must have wreaked havoc also on your ability to find that particular perspective, because if one changes emotionally, one also changes artistically as well.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. Well, what I had was a big stagnant mess before I went into rehab. I knew I wanted to do this project. I knew I needed to be free of my father. I knew that doing this project was going to help me do that. And I, for some reason, couldn't do that final push, you know, finishing the book. Once I went into rehab and got sober and got new clarity and perspective came out, that was when I sat down and everything just started to flow and I put it all together.
Yeah. Now, the book, I don't want to give it away, but
right.
it does end on a certain point of memorialization.
Mm-hmm.
Memorialization. Is that really, though, the way to exercise one's demons, to just write them out like this? I don't want to get too personal in this. You had mentioned something about the idea of being updatable earlier on. But... you could memorialize this thing, and hypothetically, you're not necessarily going to corral everything like this because our memory stays with us. This goes back to another issue I had raised earlier about the bifurcation between the private life and the public life. So I must ask if you truly have exercised this tremendous story, or whether writing is really the proper way to exercise it.
No, let me be clear. Let me clear that up a little bit. I don't think writing is the proper way to exercise something like this. It's therapy. It's, you know, getting sober or whatever you have to do. I mean, writing is a way that I processed a lot of this story early on. But if I had published that, believe me, you wouldn't want to read it. You know, so I had to sort of process all of this before I ever could write it in a form that was ready to be published.
Yeah.
You know, there had to be some perspective there.
Sure.
And as far as whether I've exercised it, it's a work in progress. I mean, I feel like I'm freed of this need to constantly talk about my father, which is a great feeling for me.
But here you are talking about it.
Well, except when I'm talking about my book, which is about my father.
Yeah.
So yes, of course, I'm going to be talking about my father probably for years to come whenever I talk about my book. But I don't feel the need to connect to other people by talking about my father. I don't feel the need to, you know, seduce a man or relax a celebrity before I interview them by bringing up the story of my father.
Yeah.
And that is a big change, because I brought up the story about my father because that was my perceived sense of identity, and it's not anymore.
Yeah.
So as far as, you know, have I exercised those demons, I feel very strongly that I'm free of something. Now, I have to, as far as what happens now in my personal life, we'll see. You know, the book just came out a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, I've been in the thick of promoting it, so it's been that.
I'm going to bring up a moral question here.
Sure.
I mean, you say that you're free with bringing it up personally, but essentially, if we accept a book as a sort of personal conduit from author to reader, mm-hmm. you are doing the exact same thing to the reader, to people who don't actually know you personally. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I'm wondering if ethically it's actually more or less the same thing that you were doing even before you memorialized the story.
Wait, but can you say that again?
Yeah.
What are you saying that I'm doing to the reader?
The suggestion is whether it is ethically similar in relation to, say, a reader who picks up the story, whether you're seducing that reader by having this particular
story. That's an interesting point.
I'm curious if you feel any particular ethical qualms about doing that. I mean, yes, it's a permanent capsule, essentially, that someone could pick up, but nevertheless, someone may, in fact, be seduced and think that is you, and you actually know, you have this added ethical dilemma, you know?
I think that's actually a great point to bring up, and my feeling is, when I was using it to seduce a guy, for example, or to get a celebrity to relax and tell me more information about their life, I was trying to engage in a dialogue with another person and kind of get something out of them and get something back from them, you know, by presenting this story. A reader is someone who, for the most part, I never end up getting to meet.
Yeah.
And I feel like, just based on my own experience with memoirs, you know, reading Catherine Harrison's The Kiss, for example, these are stories that people put out into the world. They package them in this beautiful way. It's a piece of art. And it allowed me to feel like, wow, it's actually okay to tell the truth. The truth doesn't kill. I mean, my father would threaten to kill himself and, you know, insinuate that maybe I might be killed if I tell this story. So on some level, I thought, oh, the truth kills. And I was afraid to tell the truth. When I would read these memoirs by these people who shared this incredibly deep and personal stories about their lives, it showed me, even in the safety of my own home, wow, the truth doesn't kill. It's okay. It's necessary to tell the truth. And so I think on some level, I feel actually like ethically it's doing much more of a service than a disservice. I mean, I'm not putting the book out in the world to try to get people to love me.
Yeah.
I'm putting it out into the world because, you know, it was important for me personally to tell my story. And then as a side byproduct of it, I hope that someone else will read it and say, I'm not afraid to tell my own truth.
But certainly you still have fears in telling the truth, that maybe there are some truths that you actually can't put forth and document in any capacity. I don't know. You tell me.
Well, actually,
how fearless are you?
Huh? Wait, what's up?
How fearless are you?
I think I'm pretty fearless. You read my book.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. There's nothing that I feel is a dark skeleton in my closet that I'm hiding at this point. I think it's just more a question of, you know, nobody wants to see every single thing that, you know, about your life that you're going to share with the public. I mean, the public wouldn't be interested in that. This is a story, you know, that I'm sharing. And the things that are relevant to this story are in the book. So as far as sharing every single detail about my life, I mean, who cares? Who would even want to hear about that?
So, yeah.
You know.
Unless you have a Facebook account, which you're in trouble. Lori, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you so much.
Just what she does to me somewhere deep inside. And it's not right to leave her not feeling right. And every time I have her close to me, I know deep inside. But sometimes it's too hard for me to describe.